Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Tyler.
Quick disclaimer before we start this show. We actually recorded this before the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent nationwide protests.
Since then, we've been really trying to grow as allies, and we're trying to become stronger in our fight for racial equality across this country.
That being said, this episode does touch on race and its representation in the piece of pop culture we'll be discussing today.
It is important to understand that this is historical in terms of where it came from, but not representative of where we need to be in it as a culture.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
My name is Bond.
Bond.
It's Bond.
Bond.
It's Bond.
It's Bond.
James Bond. Bond.
Hello and welcome to Pop Culture Brews, the podcast where we take a piece of pop culture we absolutely love, do way too deep a dive on it, and then at the end of it, we reveal to you the beer we were inspired to brew by it. I'm your host, Andrew.
And I'm your other host, Tyler.
And you might notice that we sound like we're in two different places, and that's because we are.
Shocking.
I know. Doing social distancing, we are recording in two separate places from each of our houses.
That's
and
right.
Yeah, good health.
Good health. Cheers.
Digital cheers. Clink. Miss you, buddy.
Miss you too, man.
So
it's not the same.
It really isn't. You know, I prefer you like coming over here, drinking a few beers, talking nonsense.
It helps get us ready, our vocal cords well lubricated to make a good show.
It is important to have well lubricated vocal cords. Well,
that's right.
speaking of vocal cords,
for today's
intro question, favorite Bond theme song.
Yeah, I love that we're just jumping into this. This is such a huge topic. It's like important just to get right into
it. Like James Bond in a room full of women, it's important to get into it.
Just pick your favorite and just go with it.
So yeah, favorite Bond theme.
You know, everybody like, you know, if you don't say Goldfinger by Shirley Bassey saying it, like, you know, the number one
Bond
song of all
yeah.
time, you're wrong. But
right,
just to like
favorite.
Mix it up a bit, I'm gonna pick two. That I'm
okay.
going to throw out there.
All right.
One of them is Shirley Bassey's Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh, love it.
I love that song. I just think of it, I just, Diamonds Are Forever. Yeah. And then the other one is the Paul McCartney one.
Oh, Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Yeah.
I love that movie way too much.
How terrible. Yeah. Yeah. Is that the one that has like the voodoo magic?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yep. And James Bond obviously handles it very very skillfully. Actually, we should talk about it because there's an interesting thing about Roger Moore released his diaries released his diaries from that time. And so I will get into it. Live and Let Die is basically James Bond does blaxploitation. Which is hilariously
doesn't work well because it's a white actor.
It doesn't work well because it's not only is it a white actor, it's a British white actor wandering around Harlem with some very, very questionable lines. But there was this big controversy when Live and Let Die was being made in that he was going to sleep with Agent Carter, who is an African-American female from the FBI. Or the CIA, and
yeah, she saved Captain America.
She
and
did.
They became lovers eventually.
There you go.
Or is that a different Agent Carter?
I think that's a different Agent Carter.
Oh, okay.
And now that I say it, I don't know that a lady's name is Agent Carter, but just go with it. And a lot of white people were disgusted that Roger Moore or a white actor was going to be shown intimate with a lady of a different race. And Roger Moore in his diaries was like, yeah, I know the controversy about this, and it just makes me want to play it more. And you're like, you are awesome, Roger Moore.
You get it.
You get some,
Roger Moore. All right, what's your favorite song?
All right, so obviously Goldfinger is a classic. I actually have the vinyl of that one, and
oh, nice.
I blare it out way too much. But my other one is The Spy Who Loved Me, Carly Simon.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. I would not think that one.
It's, right. I mean, it's because to me, The Spy Who Loved Me is probably the best Roger Moore movie. And they get everything right in that film. Like, they get enough of, like, the classic Connery big style. I mean, the plot is essentially a remake of You Only Live Twice, except they don't make Bond Japanese in it. but they also get enough of Roger Moore's lightness and fun with the character. It's also the introduction of Jaws. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that Bond theme, after going from funky white reggae of Live and Let Die, funky disco with Lulu singing The Man with the Golden Gun, they, which, you know, Lulu, amazing and a national treasure, they kind of went back to basics and went, no, we need like this sweeping, romantic, over-the-top Bond theme. Yeah. And that's what you got with The Spy Who Loved Me.
Can I throw out, I love Bond songs. I think they're so fascinating.
Yeah.
I want to throw out some honorable mentions, and you can tell me whether you agree or disagree with them.
Hit me.
All right. Thunderball by Tom Jones.
Oh, Thunderball. Bond number 4. Love it.
Yeah, that I love that song. Like, Tom Jones, like, what a guy. You gotta bring him in, right? Like,
yeah.
and then I'll throw out one more. Adele, the Skyfall song.
Oh, when the sky
If you have a Bond song and it makes it onto the radio and it's consistently played to this day, which is one of the reasons why I picked the Paul McCartney song.
Yeah.
It's a classic. You have to pick that one. So I'll just throw out Tom Jones and Adele.
Yeah.
I want to throw out another question to you.
Sure.
As like a subsection to this other question.
Okay.
Do you have a worse Bond, like the worst Bond song?
Oh yeah. For Your Eyes Only. And which is from the movie
Sheena Easton.
Oh my god, I hate that song. well, actually, no, because it kind of goes in a few eras. Because okay. I'm only thinking classic, and I'm not actually including Daniel Craig's movies in this.
Yeah.
So I'll go two classics, and then the absolute fucking worst one. Now we're an E rating from the Daniel Craig era. And so you got that one. You have All Time High from Moonraker, which I love that movie. It is cheesy beyond belief, but that song just fails on every count.
I don't think I know that one.
It's an all-time high.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. I've blocked it from my memory. Yeah. That's what happened.
And then from the Daniel Craig era. So I think there's a Daniel Craig movie that is more controversial than the most controversial in his canon. And Daniel Craig movies seem to have, in the public's opinion, the reverse Star Trek, where in Star Trek, the even-numbered movies are good and the odd-numbered ones are bad, and Daniel Craig is the opposite. Casino Royale was amazing. Quantum of Solace, not so great.
We're going to have a disagreement.
No, I love Quantum of Solace. I'm in the minority there. Spectre. Yeah. Skyfall. Amazing. Perhaps my favorite Bond movie after From Russia with Love. Then you get The Abomination. The one that I wish could be stricken from the record. Spectre. Sam Smith, when he got the call, he's like, oh my god, this is just how I imagine he talks. Oh my god, it's amazing. And I wrote this song in 5 minutes. And I'm like, it shows, Sam Smith. It shows.
I don't even, I know what song you're talking about. I also, that's one of those songs I just completely blocked in my head because I thought it was terrible.
It is awful. And there's like tentacle porn happening.
Yeah, the intro to that movie is disturbing beyond all belief.
It's like you're watching a Japanese hentai movie.
Yeah.
Which, if you don't know what that is, incognito mood, people. we're not making a beer for hentai.
No.
And then the thing that really annoys me about that movie is like I can forgive a bad theme song in a Bond movie because, you know, some good ones have had terrible songs. But like that movie starts out pretty solid.
Mm-hmm.
And then the halfway mark happens when they're in the desert And then you get a really cool desert scene, but right before that really cool video game shootout, you get, "Oh yeah, James, we all raised as brothers," from Blofeld, spoilers in this episode. And then the movie just descends into this really weird self-parody that even Roger Moore would be going, "Darling, I think you went a little too far."
Too much. I absolutely hate Casino Royale. I hate that Daniel Craig movie. I think it's
really
terrible.
Why do you hate that?
It's just terrible. First of all, the song, the song to that movie, you play it and you hear it and you're like, we're in for a rough go right now.
But can we just say R.I.P. Chris Cornell?
Sorry, Chris.
Yeah, one of the greatest rock vocalists of all time. But all right, okay.
This killed your career.
You know my name by Chris Cornell. You're not a fan.
No, that song is awful. The other one that I really really hate is it's the one with Jack White.
Oh, that is Quantum of Solace. Oh, I can't remember. Is that
Another Way to Die?
Another Way to Die. Yeah, that I don't.
I like Quantum of Solace.
I like Quantum of Solace.
Okay, so we're both in the minority here.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't like Casino Royale.
Oh yeah, we can get into it later. But those two, but like historically, the one that Duran Duran did.
Oh, Dancing to the Fire from View to a Kill from 1983. Yeah, that's amazing.
No.
Was it 83? No, that was 85. Sorry, that was 85.
Yeah.
83 was Octopussy.
Yes, Octopussy, another terrible song. It was okay. It's like kind of the weird cheesy Bond thing.
What's the song from Octopussy?
All Time High.
Oh, so what's Moonrakers?
You picked All Time High.
Yeah.
No, that's Rita Coolidge.
All Time High was Rita Coolidge. Yeah. I thought that was to Moonraker, not Octopussy.
No, Moonraker is Shirley Bassey, and it's just called Moonraker.
Nope, not
all like that.
Well, I stand corrected. I am not the fan I thought I was.
Yeah, that's it. This podcast is over.
This podcast, we've lost all our listeners.
You're an imposter. Also, Tina Turner.
Tina Turner, 1995's GoldenEye. GoldenEye.
I hate Tina Turner to begin with.
Whoa.
I won't say hate. I extremely dislike Tina Turner.
Listen to her stuff with Ike.
Yeah.
Proud Mary is a classic.
I think we've gone through all the songs.
Well, I have pop quiz for you, Hotshot.
Okay.
Who wrote GoldenEye, the song?
I don't know.
U2's Bono and The Edge.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they wrote that. And it was a number one in the UK for, like, weeks.
Interesting. I love you, too. And
I love you!
Now that I know that song, I know that Tina Turner really spoiled it. Just completely ruined it. It was not the writing at all. It was just Tina Turner ruining that song.
So, I think it's important to note that there's actually two Bonds in this world. There's the original novel James Bond, and then there's the James Bond that we're all probably more familiar with and know and love.
Correct. Okay.
So James Bond was created by a British writer, Ian Fleming, with the first novel being Casino Royale in 1953. And what was cool about Ian Fleming was he actually worked for the precursor to MI5 and MI6 in World War II as a spy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So there's numerous real-life influences on the character of James Bond. One is the father of famous actor and raconteur Peter Ustinov, whose father was, I want to say he was Ukrainian, but he worked as a secret agent for the British and the Allies during World War II. And this guy was an all-out action man, was very romantic with the ladies, and, you know, really, really did a solid for the Allies during World War II. And so he's one influence. And then the other influence is actually famed children's author Roald Dahl.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Roald Dahl was actually a spy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I know that he was a racist jerk, but
so was Ian Fleming.
That hated children.
So was Ian Fleming. Yeah, and so Roald Dahl was actually a known philanderer, And he was actually sent on an official mission to the United States to try and gather state secrets from America by essentially acting as a honeypot, which, if you're not familiar with fictional and realistic spy parlance, a honeypot is someone whose mission is basically through amorous activities gain information. So yep. Next time you read Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, know someone probably named his penis that.
He is a gross man.
He was a gross man. So yeah, Ian Fleming wrote a ton of Bond novels, and James Bond in the novels is really the biggest Mary Sue in fiction, I think. He's tall, good looking, has very refined tastes, an action man, and kind of angry at the world and racist and sexist.
Yeah, I never really understood why he was so racist, but
I think for the reasons we just mentioned. And so the novels are a very strange affair. In one of them, and I believe it's The Man with the Golden Gun, you don't have the character Scaramanga, who in the movie is played by Christopher Lee. That actually ends with Blofeld in a field surrounded by landmines wearing a suit of armor. In the novel Moonraker, gone is the really cool plot where James Bond goes to space, and it's replaced with yet another card game, which is the main plot of Casino Royale.
Yes.
And to be honest with you, the novels are crap. I cannot stand the novels. I've read a couple of them, and I like to collect the old 60s paperbacks because the covers are really cool whenever you find them, but they're just awful.
I think I tried to read Casino Royale back when I was in like high school.
Yeah.
And I quit. It was bad.
Yeah.
I think James Bond is one of the few scenarios where it's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah.
That the movies are much better than the book itself.
Absolutely. But what was interesting about James Bond was, you know, they try to really get them traction in the United States. And so the first time James Bond was played on screen, it was famously played by an American actor. Barry Nelson, yes, who went by the name Jimmy Bond. In Climax Theater, which was a weekly one-hour live studio drama play of Casino Royale, and he was Jimmy Bond from the CIA, and he was trying to take down Peter Lorre, who was the main villain in M and Hitchcock's original The Man Who Knew Too Much. It's a really fun thing to watch if you look it up on YouTube, the original Casino Royale.
I've never seen it.
It's really good. It's good in that kind of 1950s TV kind of way, which
black and white,
very blocky, very staged, everyone foreign has an outrageous accent.
1950s.
And so in the 60s, two film producers took notice of the novels, and those were Albert R. Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, who went to Ian Fleming and went, hey, you know what would be really great? We should make your books into movies.
Ian Fleming said, I like money.
Yeah, precisely. Let's do that. Yeah, he wasn't an artist. And because Casino Royale, the rights had been sold for the TV show, and I think at that time were owned by MGM, they couldn't get the rights to do Casino Royale first, so they chose the novel Dr. No, which was set in the Caribbean, so I can only imagine that book treats its subject matter great.
And just super well, yeah.
Just super well. And they made Dr. No with then really unknown Scottish actor Sean Connery in a star-making role.
They were trying to get, like, I think it was like Cary Grant to play James Bond. Cary Grant was like, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm actually a famous actor.
Yes, I'm Cary Grant. Now, the cool thing about Cary Grant was Cary Grant, as the swish American debonair gentleman that he is, British.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it would have worked.
It would have. I mean, he would have been like the suave, good actor that James Bond made. If Cary Grant got that role, how different the franchise would have become, you know? Like, he would have lent, like, respectability maybe to the role and, like, given, like, kind of a serious, straightforward path with these movies. But as you'll see, Sean Connery, and then, you know, historical movies after that,
kind of goes a different way.
Yeah, it descends into madness sometimes.
Yeah, and the madness is great. Now, if you want like if you want the precursor to James Bond with Cary Grant, watch North by Northwest by Alfred Hitchcock.
I love North by Northwest.
It is
one of my favorite movies.
We are going to have to do a beer for North by Northwest because that is my favorite Hitchcock movie. But the filmmakers really took that as the inspiration for kind of the template of Bond. And so they make Dr. No, and they introduce Sean Connery, who wore a wig in every Bond movie he was in. This is where you get a lot of the tropes of tuxedos, smoking, gambling,
drinking, women.
Beautiful women, car chase. And it is perhaps the most straightforward kind of being a spy movie of the entire series.
Yeah. I love Dr. No.
Yeah.
I think it's up there as one of my favorites. It's in my top five. I'll say that.
Dr. No is a class. I think it gets unfairly overlooked because it is the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And like each Bond movie tries to up the stakes and ups the stakes.
Yeah. Maybe at the end of this, we can kind of briefly run through our top five Bond films. Maybe.
That's going to be a challenge, but okay. But I think only sticking to classic era, not Daniel Craig. And because I have this weird rule about it. Daniel Craig was a reboot.
Interesting. Okay.
Because otherwise my answer is just Skyfall. I bloody love Skyfall.
I think you can stick to the classics. I might break your rule a little bit.
You can break my rule a little bit.
We'll see.
So he proceeds to make four more Bond movies. From Russia with Love, which is a great, great movie and is actually my favorite Bond movie.
Don't give away your list now.
Okay. just because real Cold War and just a great piece of 60s cinema. But then you get perhaps you get Connery's finest moment here.
Goldfinger.
I mean, Goldfinger is hopelessly quotable. The amazing, amazing theme song. A character called Pussy Galore, played by Honor Blackman, who sadly died this week that we are recording. Yeah. She was 93, had a good life, so power to you.
Rest in peace, Galore.
And who famously begins the movie as a lesbian until she meets James Bond.
James Bond turned him straight since 1962.
As we talk about James Bond, I'm realizing how offensive these movies are.
Oh, these movies are like terribly offensive.
They're so offensive. I'm beginning to see why my wife doesn't really like them.
Yeah, Lauren doesn't like them either. I think it's funny, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit. When you get to Pierce Brosnan's era, they're really grappling with that a lot. Like
they are.
Pierce Brosnan's like this suave, debonair, like James Bond, not really much of a badass, but they're like trying to make him like a womanizer without making him like without setting him up to be this like enemy of feministas everywhere. Yeah, you know,
Goldfinger. So there's this great moment, and I use great in air marks as I say this, but there's this famous moment that Bond is on at Miami Beach getting a massage by a very attractive blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And Felix Leiter, who's his CIA counterpart, comes up to him and says, "Hey, Bond, we gotta talk about spy shit." And Sean Connery stands up, turns the girl around, slaps her on the ass, and says, "Run along now, man talk." Can you imagine if Pierce Brosnan in 1995 tried that?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean...
Yeah, and so I think it's funny because there's a lot of time between, well, not a lot, but Daniel Craig and Pierce Brosnan, there's like 4 years, which in Bond time, that's a good amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was really them trying to rework the Bond formula.
Yeah.
You know, like, how do we make Bond be a womanizer and also respectful towards women?
I mean, I think Brosnan played it really well because, and I'm gonna do a real quick jump across the series, because I mean, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with it, but you get like Connery, who's like 60s over the top, then you get Lazenby, who's only in for one.
Lazenby.
Lazenby. only in for one movie, and that's the movie where he gets married, and then mm-hmm. Tracy, who is played by Diana Rigg, who is really, really old in Game of Thrones. I recommend you checking her out in the original series of The Avengers with Patrick McNee, because she's insanely beautiful. She gets murdered. Then you get Connery coming back for Diamonds Are Forever, which I love.
And there's no mention of the wife.
There's no mention of the wife. Just he begins the movie tracking down Blofeld, who's responsible for her demise.
He's grieving well.
He's grieving very well with lots of murder and sex.
That's right.
And then you get Roger Moore, who plays... He plays Bond as someone who was good at killing but doesn't enjoy it. And Roger Moore is just a lover.
He's like the good... There's like spectrums of Bond, right? Like you have like the badasses that always fight and like that's the meaning of their existence.
Which Sean really Connery, is Connery, Dalton, Craig.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have like the suave lovers that know how to, you know, woo people into telling them what they need. Like the true like essence of a spy. Yeah. You know, not bold and like brash, but like undercover. And that's the Moores and the Brosnans.
I would argue how Roger Moore begins.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because Roger Moore, by the middle of it, realizes, I'm a spy who walks into a bar and everyone knows who I am. I guess I'm going to have fun.
Yep.
Let's take James Bond to space. And then you get Timothy Dalton, who I actually really like as James Bond.
Good for you, because I absolutely hate him.
Yeah, and so Dalton is an interesting guy. Timothy Dalton plays him very seriously. He actually plays him a lot like the books, minus the racism. And you actually run into a situation where they ran out of material to adapt after his first movie, The Living Daylights, which is a very awkward Bond where he teams up with the Taliban. Different times. And so...
Afghanistan's confusing.
It really is. For geopolitics, please reach out to Tyler Mabey at TMabes1 on Twitter.
And catch my next episode of Geopolitics and You.
And so they do License to Kill, which actually then becomes a much more run-of-the-mill 80s action movie where you've got Robert Davi as a drug baron and Bond sent in to stop him and destroy him. There's lots and lots of violence. It's perhaps still the most violent Bond movie to this day.
It's just too much.
It was one of the first ones I watched along with View to a Kill, which is Roger Moore's last one. And the tonal difference between them is hilarious.
I think one of the reasons why I don't like Timothy Dalton, and maybe even, it might even not be his fault. It might just be Bond in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, I think of other 80s movies that have come out during this time.
Yeah.
Like action movies or, you know, there's so much better and like more well done and like produced correctly. And then you get like this James Bond movie that's like, I still want to be in the 70s, but I have all this money to do 80s things, but I don't really know how to do 80s things. So I'm going to like just blow shit up.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird because when they go from Moore to Dalton, they kind of go from what are family movies, family action movies, kind of Indiana Jonesy. You know, I think we've spoken about this before. In the UK, definitely, it is a big deal when you watch your first Bond movie with your dad or your uncle. Like, I still remember my first Bond movie. That will forever be your favorite Bond movie. It doesn't matter if it's like Die Another Day. You will love that movie.
I was going to say that was actually my first Bond movie.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, which, to your point... And I know now how terrible that movie is, but it has a fondness in my heart.
Yes.
Because that is like one of the, I guess it was the first Bond movie I saw in theaters.
Yeah.
And so it has a connection with me. Like people, going back to the songs, people always say that the Madonna song at the beginning of that movie is one of the worst Bond songs.
I would
agree. And for some reason, I find it catchy. And like, I think it's because I saw it in the theaters and it was like, I was 12 years old. Another and like... Day. Yeah. And I was 12 years old and I was like, oh, this is flashy and actiony, and like, I like this type, like this kind of movie. And
you,
so
you were in eighth grade.
I was 12 years old.
I was at university.
And there's the reference to our aging.
I remember seeing it with like this episodes. Girl I was seeing, and oh god.
But yeah, I think to your point, like, it doesn't matter what your first Bond movie is, it like quickly climbs to a point in your list of like, I respect that one because I like that one.
Precisely. You know? And I mean, you can go through like what are like the good Bond movies, the bad Bond movies. Every Bond movie is insanely watchable because it's a Bond movie.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah.
Simple. It's a spy. There's a megalomaniac. There's beautiful women and lots of violence.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so they go from Roger Moore, who was really kind of more family fare, even though one of his movies was called Octopussy, to Timothy Dalton, whose first movie, The Living Daylights, I would say is a lot, it leans more closely to Roger Moore, but you can tell there's this shift in tone. He plays it a lot grittier. And then you get License to Kill, which in the UK was the oldest rated Bond movie at the cinema. So you went from Bond movies being like PG, PG-13 to a 15, which over here might have pushed it into R-rated territory. And then they had,
or they just stretched what PG-13 meant.
Or they thank you, Spielberg. And so then you had this big gap between 89, thank you. 1989, yeah. License to Kill, to 1995's GoldenEye.
Which is like decades. Which like is millennia in the Bond world.
Yeah, because, I mean, when I remember being a teenager, so to age myself, I was 12 when GoldenEye
came out.
Yeah, shut up. But no, I was 12 when GoldenEye came out, and I remember going to see it in the movie theater. But up until that point, James Bond movies were those old movies I watched on TV.
Yeah.
And it was a huge deal. And so Pierce Brosnan comes in and begins playing James Bond. Now, the great thing about Pierce Brosnan, this is a very famous story, is he used to play a character on TV called Remington Steele. And Remington Steele was this gentleman thief, looked great in the tux, like he should have been Bond. And he was supposed to be Bond after Roger Moore. Remington Steele, it didn't look like they were going to renew the series. And so basically the deal was that if the series didn't get renewed, he could play James Bond. It's the final day of like the deadline of Remington Steele getting renewed. They hadn't heard anything, so they had organized a press conference to announce him as the new James Bond. He's leaving his house and he gets a phone call going, guess what? Remington Steele renewed for season 5. And he couldn't play James Bond. And which is like one of the saddest things ever. Where this story gets even sadder, it was the final season of Remington Steele.
Ugh. And you know that Pierce Brosnan was like, I hate this character now.
Pretty
like,
much. I think he
just ruined my Bond experience.
I think he phoned in that last season.
Oh, I'm sure. Just like Sean Connery phoning it into
Diamonds Are Forever.
Never die. You only die twice.
Oh, you only live twice. The infamous...
Never say never again.
Oh, never say never again. Well, Never Say Never Again actually has an interesting history as well.
I was talking to Lauren about this before we started recording, but there, I remember watching Never Say Never Again in my dorm room in college with a group of guys, and there are literal, like, we were just making fun of it the entire time. There are literal scenes when, like, Sean Connery's, like, you can tell he's, like, kind of fat and old, and, like, he just hates, he hates himself for being back in a Bond movie. And there's, like, a scene when he's climbing a ladder up to fight a bad guy. And you can just see the exasperation in his eyes and just like, fuck, why am I, every goddamn
okay, movie. I need the money. Well, so pop quiz then. Do you know what Never Say Never Again is a remake of?
Is it a remake of Doctor No?
No, it's a remake of Thunderball.
Oh, Thunderball. Okay.
So Thunderball is controversial in the James Bond canon because Ian Fleming was working on that script with a producer called Ian McClory. And the movie never went anywhere.
Yeah.
And so Ian Fleming was like, well, sod it, I'll just put him in a book. And so he wrote the novel Thunderball based on the ideas of his and McClory's, not giving McClory any credit.
What a jerk.
And so then the Bond producers read this really, it's the most confusing Connery movie by far, but
it's ridiculous.
It makes no sense. But they read it and they go, shit, yeah, this is our latest movie, and they make the movie while McClory sues them. And so Bond was tied up in litigation for years, to the point that McClory won the rights to use the plot of Thunderball and the character name of James Bond for one movie. And so,
and we got Never Say Never Again.
And we got Never Say Never Again. And so, like, he's calling up Sean Connery going, here's a boatload of cash because I want you to come back as Bond and make this the biggest Bond movie ever. Meanwhile, the Bond producers are going, oh, shit, McClory's already screwing us here. We better make the best Bond movie we can and release it the same year. What we got? What we got, lads? And they go through all the scripts and they go through all the books and, like, Octopussy. Do you know what would be great in this movie that we're trying to compete with Sean Connery, the James Bond? Why don't we dress James Bond up as a clown and have him run around a circus? And they went, yes, this will beat Sean Connery coming back to James Bond. And you know what? It did.
Oh my god, that movie is so terrible.
It's so terrible, but I have such a weird love of it.
Can we talk about one more movie that is not made by Eon that we have to discuss?
Are we talking about the Peter Niven, Woody Allen? David Niven, yes.
Yes. Have you seen that? I'm guessing you've seen this movie.
I've seen this movie.
How amazing is this movie?
I remember even as a kid with zero taste and very easily amused going, this isn't very good. And because it's got David Niven, it's got Peter Sellers, it's got Woody Allen, it's got bloody Orson Welles, it's mm-hmm. got women in bikinis. I mean, it's basically got everything I should love. And no.
It's just, it's the most ridiculous. I mean, I think it is so ridiculous because a little plot overview for people that might have not seen it. James Bond decides that he's going to name a bunch of other secret people, secret agents, as James Bond to confuse the bad guy. And so Sir James Bond is going to train them on how to confuse the bad guy.
This movie
and so
has
for
a
the
plot.
Entire movie, you have a bunch of different James Bonds running around on screen. And it's not only confusing to the bad guy, but it's extremely confusing to the audience.
Yeah. It is, and at one point, like, Woody Allen, who's playing the bad guy, like, starts hiccuping, and little cartoon clouds,
bubbles
yeah. come out of his mouth, and, like...
He drank poison, right? What's that?
Yeah, and, you know, I want to be clear, this is pre-very bad Woody Allen, so yeah. It's okay to like this movie.
It's 1967.
1967 Woody Allen.
Yeah, this movie is very weird. Woody Allen's character is trying to make a biological weapon in order to make all women beautiful and then kill all the tall men because he's a short man.
Which I just want to go on the record and say all women are beautiful, but you are more than your looks. You are your brains as well.
Yeah, Woody Allen. Let's calm it down.
You pig.
Oh god, that movie! It cracks me up. It's terrible.
So bad.
It's a terrible movie. But when I want to turn my brain off, and I just want to laugh, that's a movie. If I can find it, it's not often on, but it is hilarious, terrible, and great to drink to.
I was gonna say it's the kind of movie where you pour yourself an 11% beer, nothing less.
No.
I know I should say a 007% beer, but no,
oh,
an
no,
11% stop. Beer. Have two of them before you begin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so how many Bond films have there been?
No Time to Die is supposed to be Bond 25, isn't it?
Yeah, 25 of Eon.
25 of Eon. Well, they're the only ones that count. So 24 Bond movies. And what's interesting about Bond is Bond always, and we were kind of talking about this earlier, Bond always reflects the culture of which he's living. So you got Sean Connery, who is totally sexist and can have any woman he wants just by being Sean Connery, which is fair. Lazenby had one movie, so sod him.
Did you like George Lazenby's movie?
I think it's actually one of the best Bond movies. I think he's not a great Bond. If Sean Connery had been Bond in that movie, we would not talk about any other Bond movie.
I'm sure Lazenby went on to do other things and was maybe mediocre at them. No.
No.
Okay. Well,
you can't see this, but I'm shaking my head.
I'm sure his mediocrity would continue to live to this day if he wasn't so terrible.
Yeah.
In this Bond movie. But it's one of the few movies where you're like, this movie would have been good if they got a good Bond.
Well,
like, and he literally ruins this movie for me.
Well, and the thing is that, I mean, anyone following Connery, and this is where I think Roger Moore got really lucky. Anyone following Connery straight off the bat is not going to, they could have been, I mean, who's a great action star right now? I mean, it could have been Liam Neeson.
Oh, why? Why did you go that way?
Okay, it could have been Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
There we go, that's better.
Which would have been a very weird twist in the Bond canon. Bond just suddenly bald and American and heavily tattooed, but you got to smile like
he's
a million bucks.
You have to appreciate him.
Yeah, and he's a nice guy. But no, you could have had Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who, you know, throw on a Dwayne Johnson movie and I'm just entertained for like 90 minutes. Anything longer than that and I'm done. Everyone would have hated it. So, yeah. But I think what the producers went wrong with was they went with someone, or maybe they went right. Maybe this is a deliberate move. They went with someone who wasn't that great.
Devoid of personality.
Yeah, I will say he is an extraordinarily bland Bond.
Yeah, it's amazing how bland he is. He blends right in.
He really does. What saves on Her Majesty is actually Diana Rigg. Now, Diana Rigg became famous because she was in this TV show, The Avengers of Patrick McNee, where each week it was an Adventure of the Week show and they were spies or something. I don't know. And they just go. Yeah. And they just go on adventures and he's a dandy and she's an action woman. And she was really one of the first, to my knowledge, female characters on TV who really, really held her own. And so she comes into this movie and obviously everyone has a preconceived idea of who this character is. And she really is the first Bond girl to be a challenge to James Bond.
Yeah.
I mean, she still sleeps with him. But
yeah, I mean, like I said, the storyline is really great.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a different, it shakes things up. It completely, completely separates from Sean Connery and tries to go a different direction.
Yeah.
They just failed in who they picked as James Bond. I'm sorry, George.
It's okay. He's also not a great guy.
Well, then I'm not sorry. No, you're a jerk. Lazenby.
And so then they bring Connery back for Diamonds Are Forever. And then you get Roger Moore. And I think Roger Moore got so much more forgiveness from the public. Because when Connery came back from Thunderball, he's a little puffier. He's a little older. He kind of clearly doesn't give a shit what movie he's in.
No.
I love that movie, but yeah, Connery did not do his finest performance that I think the audience went, well, at least he's better than Lazenby, but can we get someone good, please?
Yeah.
Then they gave it to Roger Moore, who, based on his work in the old TV show The Saint, was actually who Ian Fleming always wanted James Bond to be played by.
Well, there you go.
There you go. That was a lot of history in 30 seconds.
Do we want to try to run through maybe like top three? Let's try five,
Let's, let's do top five. I think. I mean,
maybe give a quick little plot synopsis.
Oh, actually, yeah, I was gonna say top seven, but that's just too much.
Ooh, that's too much. That's 14 between the two of us.
Let's do top five with a one sentence description.
In no particular order.
In no particular order. Ooh, this is challenging. All right, so my fifth favorite Bond movie is probably GoldenEye. And That is the first Pierce Brosnan movie. It is a story about a spy trying to stop Russia from restarting the Cold War. It was the greatest reintroduction to this classic character because Brosnan played him classically enough that he kind of feels out of place with the environment that he's in, and they keep making fun of that in the movie.
Yeah, I actually hated this movie, so I'm glad that you said it. How do you
know? He drives a tank through the streets of St. Petersburg. How do you hate this movie?
I don't know. It just doesn't connect with me. And you know what? You can make fun of my number five, because my number five is Pierce Brosnan's Die Another Day.
Oh, okay.
It's so ridiculous. It's been, a guy gets diamonds shattered into his face, and they're in North Korea. Pierce Brosnan is captured and is a war criminal, and then gets out of the war criminal and escapes to Hong Kong, and then saves the world from there. And Halle Berry shows up randomly in Cuba.
Yeah, she's the bright spot of the movie. Her and yeah. Amanda Pike.
Amanda Pike, yes.
That's yes.
It. Yep. Oh. Amanda Pike, Halle Berry, a 12-year-old boy. I had no chance. Of course, that movie is going to be number five on my list.
I like to call it Die Another Day, : if Moonraker wasn't enough, he has an invisible car.
Diamonds in the face, man.
Diamonds out of the face. All right, so my number four. Damn it, this is challenging off the top of my head. My number four is probably Live and Let Die, which was Roger Moore's first movie, the blaxploitation one. It's for all of its faults, and there are a lot of faults with this movie. It's just ridiculously fun, and the villain is amazing, Mr. Kananga. But also, you had a very young Jane Seymour play Solitaire.
I don't put this in my top five, but it's decent. I would say it's mid-level for me.
Mid-level? All right.
Yeah. My number four would be Skyfall. I know that you want to stick with the classics.
I'm struggling. I'm gonna have to bring in classy go let you have that.
And so maybe that was on your list, but I'll say it for both of us. And I think Skyfall, just phenomenal. Like, it's about, you know, I think the plot of it is someone is out to get Dame Judi Dench.
Dame Judi.
She's at the end of her career, and someone comes back to haunt her, and Daniel Craig has feelings and saves her.
Some men are coming here to kill us. We're going to kill them first.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it turns into...
I love that movie. It's so good. It is like quintessential Bond, and the villain is like perfect.
Oh, Javier Bardem.
Oh, God. Talk about a great person to play a villain.
Oh, so good. And what the best description I ever heard of the movie was right after it came out, and I worked at a cinema marketing company, and so we were all up on like the latest movies. And just listen to one executive tell another executive, it's like, yeah, in the final act, it just turns into a really violent version of Home Alone.
So true.
And then he just goes, but I really like Home Alone.
Yeah.
So this is the greatest description.
Yeah, I love that movie. So that's my number four.
All right, my number three, another problematic movie.
You and your problematic movie. I'm glad that you like these because I...
You Only Live Twice.
Oh, God, really? Why is that on your list?
Okay, so You Only Live Twice. You remember how I told you about Roald Dahl?
Yes.
He wrote the screenplay.
Did he really?
He wrote the screenplay. Now, I'm not sure there's a plot to You Only Live Twice. Fun fact, it is the only Bond movie where Bond doesn't drive a car. Random fact. But what does Bond do in this movie, you might ask? Well, he undergoes reconstructive surgery to turn him Japanese. They basically dye his hair black, put black eyebrows on him, and some rather terrible eye makeup, and Sean Connery is like, konnichiwa. It's so bad. But you then have this amazing scene in a hollowed out volcano, which is Blofeld's lair, which has a monorail, and like the Japanese secret services like come in and slide down ropes, and there's a big gunfight at the end. It's just incredibly bonkers.
That's not my favorite. I'm glad you put that on your list. My number three, and you'll probably be mad at me for saying it's three, it probably should be higher, but I'm just going to say it, From Russia with Love.
Oh, you stole my movie. Okay. You stole my movie. All right. This is reordering things for me right now. But, okay. Right.
So From Russia with Love, I mean, it's an actual spy movie, like in the heart of the Cold War. I think just the way that it's written, you have like Dr. No is trying to seek, people are trying to seek revenge on Dr. No dying from Spectre. You got the woman with the knife shoe. I mean, I don't know. Like, it's just, it's a great movie. I'll let you give the plot summary since I stole it from you, but I love this movie a lot.
Well, I mean, so essentially it's exactly that. Russia tried to infiltrate MI6 by MI5 rather, by sending a postcard of a rather attractive special agent, XXX, to James Bond that says "From Russia with Love," and they're like, "We think it's a trap, but Bond, you look like you want to bone her. Go and get her.
Go."
So Bond goes and gets this girl. Hijinks ensue, and it was the first introduction of Spectre in the series, which as an overarching plot line, which is one of the only ones in the entire series. But it's atmospheric, it's fun, it's probably Connery's best performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's really good. All right, what's your number three? Or
actually, I want to tell one story about From Russia with Love.
Okay.
I used to live with a Russian girl when I was at university. And she was one of the sweetest people I've ever known, Evelina. And she had never seen a Bond movie because they were all banned in Russia for some reason. I don't know.
Who knows why?
And so we were talking one day, a group of us talking in Bond games. I was just like, I've heard of these movies, I've never seen them. And I'm like, well, okay. So I brought my TV out, my VCR, Tyler. My VCR. It's a VHS player. It's what we had before DVD. And I showed her a couple of old Bond movies, and she enjoyed them. Like, they weren't her theme, but she's like, oh, now I know what you're talking about. And after that, like, when we used to exchange Christmas cards, she would always sign them From Russia with Love, which was just so sweet of her. She was such a lovely girl. All right, my number two. Damn you for taking that one.
Now you gotta start taking the ones that I think I'm gonna use.
Honestly, I think, all right, this is a very personal choice for me. My number two, even though it's no one's favorite, but it was the first one I saw, View to a Kill. Which,
God, your list is terrible. Try again. We're doing this all over again.
You took Skyfall and From Russia with Love from me. No, View to a Kill, which is Roger Moore is probably 20 years too old to be playing the character, and has Christopher Walken, and is about a megalomaniac's plan to flood Silicon Valley so he can control the world's microchip market. And it ends with a really cool set piece on the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, what was really cool about this movie is there's this action sequence in San Francisco City Hall, and they had to get permission to film in, and everyone told them, you're not going to get permission to film in there because you want to set it on fire and do a bunch of stunts, and we don't really want violence in our city hall. Well, the woman who was the mayor at the time or in charge of that decision was, as Roger Moore tells it, one of the only people on this planet who thought I was better than Sean and said we could do it. So that's how they got permission to film in the San Francisco City Hall. Don't shake that's your hilarious. Head at me.
It's a terrible movie.
It is terrible, but it begins in Paris, and it's got that great... No, it begins with a ski thing. The opening credits.
I do like that ski thing.
The ski thing is pretty cool with the Beach Boys, and then it goes to Paris, and then Christopher Walken turns up, and he's unhinged, and he's the result of German Nazi testing.
I thought A View to Kill... Wait, which one did you say?
A View to a Kill.
Yeah, okay. That is the one with the ski one. Yeah. Is there another movie that has a ski intro to it?
Yes, but I'm not going to tell you which one because that's my number one.
Okay. I'm sorry if I take it without knowing that I'm taking it. Yeah, so,
hit me.
My number two is The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yes, okay, but that is a fucking terrible movie.
Really?
Yes!
Why is it terrible?
Oh my god, you go from the gritty realism blaxploitation of Live and Let Die. Actually, no, it's pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
Christopher Lee is Scaramanga. Yeah,
Scaramanga is like one of the best, like one of the best Bond villains. With so his, I just feel like he has to be on this list
with his tertiary nipple.
Yeah, he's got three nipples. If anybody didn't know that.
And who plays Scaramanga?
Christopher Lee.
Christopher no. Lee, who yeah. was cousins with Ian Fleming.
Oh well, there you go.
There you go. Yeah.
He puts the homing device on Scaramanga's car and then falls. It's like it's all good. It's a great movie.
I mean, it's kind of problematic because
a pistol duel on a beach. Like, what more do you want?
Well, because Scaramanga has a person of diminutive stature as his assistant, and during a fight scene, Roger Moore puts him in a suitcase.
Yes, there is that.
But it also stars Maud Adams, who is the only Bond girl to come back to the series playing a different character, because she plays Scaramanga and then Roger Moore's love interest, and then she comes back as Octopussy.
I do like Octopussy. I won't put it on my list because I know that's a terrible movie.
That's a rough one for me.
Huh?
That's a rough one.
That's a rough one for you. Yeah. I think so. Octopussy was one of the first movies I saw, like one of the very first Bond movies I ever saw.
Well, and,
that, on TV.
And that's why you're gonna love it.
Yeah. So, but I understand how rough it is. Like, I tried to rewatch it, and it is a little rough.
It's a little rough.
All right, what is your number one?
My number one, which is actually my number one Roger Moore movie, is The Spy Who Loved Me.
That's the ski scene that I really like
and
the most.
So, the famous thing about this ski scene is he's in bed with a Russian agent's girlfriend, so we're led to believe. And she's like, James, I need you. He's like, so does England. And I'm like, yeah, you're part of the British Secret Service, but all right, just choose one country out of the four. And he skis, and there's a big gunfight, and then he skis off a cliff, and you're like, oh my god, he's skiing off, he's like flying through the air, and this is all real, what's gonna happen? And then her parachute comes out, and the Union Jack is the parachute, and you get the Bond sting, ba-da, ba-da.
Yeah.
And a ski hits the parachute and you're like, oh shit, he's gonna die, but he doesn't. And then you go into the opening credits.
Yeah, I love that opening scene.
It is perhaps outside of the gun barrel scene, that is the most iconic moment of Bond for me.
That okay. Yeah, I can see that.
And I'll
give that to you.
And the plot line, exactly the same as You Only Live Twice.
Shocking.
I know, right? It's like they recycle plots. Which is about a guy who's planning world domination, but this time not from a volcano, that would be stupid. He plans it underneath the ocean.
Yes.
And
that's
so,
one of the reasons why I liked Octopussy, because like the base is all underwater and it's just really weird.
and so the Bond girl, Barbara Bach, who is also known as Mrs. Ringo Starr, spends about a third of the movie soaking wet, which watching this movie as an impressionable young boy left an impression.
Yeah, sure did.
Yeah, I have a type. So you're number one.
I mean, if I don't say Goldfinger and that is excluded from our list, are we allowed to have a podcast anymore?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I have to go with Goldfinger.
You gotta go.
I'm also going to apologize to our audience for Andrew's terrible list that left off things like Thunderball, Dr. No, Moonraker. Like, I don't... I tried to hold up the conversation, but Andrew just have to keep diving off of these weird... I know it's questionable, but conversations. Oh, my God. So, I have to go with Goldfinger, just as to make sure that our podcast is reputable.
Yeah.
I set it up for you, my friend. What the hell are these people talking about?
I set it up for you. This has been one of our most round-the-houses conversations. Like, let's start a fact.
It'll be good to cut and put and move around.
It'll be fine. No, just like we're like, here's a really interesting story about James Bond, the series. Tangent.
I got another story. These 5 movies that I think are they're really good, but are actually terrible. All right, so do I need to go over the plot of Goldfinger? Because I feel like Goldfinger is pretty well.
Goldfinger, I mean, you might as well just, the plot can be summed up in one line.
So, Ulrich Goldfinger is trying to steal all the gold from Fort Knox.
Well, okay. little correction here. What Goldfinger is trying to do, because he has a...
He wants to live his life with gold!
What he's trying to do is he has a stockpile of gold. And so he plans with Pussy Galore's Lesbian Air Force. I think that's the name of it.
Yes, I think that's...
I think that's the name of it.
The USS Lesbian.
USS Lesbian
is the aircraft carrier that they all took off from.
His plan is to spray nerve gas.
It's nerve gas. Yeah, sleeping gas.
Across Fort Knox so all the soldiers fall asleep. He then drives in with an atomic bomb. And his plan is to set off the bomb, turning the U.S. gold supply nuclear for like 100 years, driving up the price of gold that he has. That's the plot.
I mean, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant idea.
Brilliant movie.
But who's the guy with the hat in this one?
Odd Job,
that's right.
Yeah.
And he has a hat and he throws it and it's got like a metal thing in it because they like get stuck in a door and then James Bond takes the hat. It's a whole thing. It's great. It's a great movie.
Basically,
I expect you to die, James Bond.
My recommendation to you, if you haven't already or don't know, if you have, I believe, Hulu and Amazon Prime, you can pretty much watch every James Bond movie there is up to the Daniel Craigs. Daniel Craig, yeah. I know we've talked a lot about the classic Bonds. I love the Daniel Craig run, except Spectre, which is a piece of shit. I just hate that movie.
I hate Casino Royale, so...
I don't understand you.
It's so boring.
How is it boring?
It's people playing cards for 2 hours, and it's so annoying.
What about the parkour scene at the beginning?
It's such a bad movie.
I
think it was like, people were like, you know what's really popular right now on ESPN? The World Texas Hold'em Championship. We should do a whole movie with people playing Texas Hold'em.
Well, to be fair,
and then it'll be famous.
In the original book, it was Baccarat, and no one knows how to play that.
Yeah, but it's so bad. If I wanted to watch 2 hours of people playing cards,
yeah,
I would go down to the old folks' home, set up a lawn chair, and just watch them go to town.
I'm never inviting you to a poker night, partly because I don't have one. I don't have enough friends. Tony, you're my only friend.
No. I know people like Casino Royale. In fact, I think it's Lauren's favorite movie.
Yeah.
Lauren's favorite Bond movie. But I strongly dislike Casino Royale. I'm glad that they were able to turn it around with Daniel Craig when it came to Quantum of Solace, which I know that's a really
such
controversial
a minority
statement.
Minority opinion right now. Like, you're making my list
I'm
look like
rant, damn it. Let me finish.
You're making my list of, like, the greatest list of Bond movies ever, and even I know it's a piece of shit.
No, Casino Royale is terrible.
Oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong. So wrong. But after Quantum of Solace is Skyfall, which I believe is the first time you see James Bond drink a beer.
It's true. It's true.
So
there's no there was no advertising placement in that at all.
No, I mean,
just naturally ordered a beer.
I want a Heineken now.
The shit beer of Europe.
So with that, shall we talk about the beers we made for James
Absolutely.
Bond?
We should say that these beers are dedicated to our favorite James Bond character, or the favorite actor that played James
favorite
Bond.
Favorite actor. For me, second favorite, but, he was my Bond. He was my first Bond, and so I brewed a beer in his honor.
Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
I would say let's go chronological, because, you know, we're talking about the two most iconic men to play James Bond.
That's true. So I'm going first, and I brewed a beer for Mr. Sean Connery. I don't think he's Sir. Has he been knighted? I don't think he's been knighted.
I think
he should be knighted.
I think he has he, because he's for Scottish independence.
Oh, that's problematic.
That is problematic. Yikes. Let's just call him Mister as a term of respect.
Yeah, Mr. Connery.
Mr. Connery.
Here's to you, Mr. Connery.
Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you.
Oh, God.
We're so doing one on The Graduate now.
The the quintessential James Bond character, in my opinion, who was a bodybuilder before he became James Bond, who had no discernible acting talent. And he just really set this movie genre in the proper direction, in my opinion.
I would say he was the definitive gentleman spy.
That's true. Yeah. So for Mr. Connery, I brewed him a milk and honey scotch ale for obvious reasons, because he's Scottish and scotch ale, obviously. So this beer, it has a lot of malts, so hold on to your seats as I list all these things off. It has 5 pounds of Maris Otter, 0.65 pounds of caramel, 0.65 pounds of dark malt, 4 pounds of smoked malt, 1.3 pounds of flaked oat, 1.3 pounds of brown malt, 0.2 pounds of amber malt, and 1.1 pounds of chocolate English, 1.3 pounds of light Munich, and 0.5 pounds of medium crystal.
Good God, man.
I know. lots of different grains going on in that bill.
There is.
There's 1.25 ounces of first gold. You can also use East Kent or whatever. Is it East Kent?
East Kent Golding, EKG.
Yeah, EKG instead of first gold. And then, which is what I used. I used EKG. And then 1.25 ounces of Fugle hops.
Fuggle?
Yes.
Fugle? I'm British. I'm going to correct you on your pronunciation, but yeah, Fuggle.
Fuggle. Whatever. Fuggle. Then I put half a pound of honey and then 1 pound of lactose sugar into there. So you put 1 ounce of the EKG in at 60 minutes, so right when it starts boiling, and then 1 ounce of Fuggle right when it starts boiling. And then you put half a pound of honey and 1 pound of lactose in at 30 minutes. And then you put the last quarter ounce of EKG and Fuggle in at, flame out last 15 minutes, I guess. And then I used American ale yeast. It's supposed to come out to 7.3%. Mine came out to 6%, but you know.
You know, I've got to say, we've been drinking this during the episode, and it is just delightful.
It's phenomenal. It's one of my favorite beers I've done so far, next to the Mai Tai.
And we don't normally do this, but because I know what beer you were really kind of modeling this off. If you like Odell's 90 Shilling, this is better.
Yeah. Actually, so we should give a little bit of a story to this beer, which is BrewDog. The brewery are they in Cincinnati or Columbus?
Well, they're actually, so they have a hotel in Ohio, but they originate from Scotland.
Oh, they're Scottish.
They're Scottish.
Oh, I didn't know they were Scottish.
Which makes this even more appropriate.
Even better. Look at that, Sean. Look at that. I took a beer from your homeland. So this brewery, during this quarantine situation, they released a big book of every beer that they ever brewed, for home brewers. And this beer was from that book. So I just want to give a shout out to BrewDog and thank them for doing that, because they didn't have to. And your beers are amazing.
Yeah, I always make sure that when you're at the GABF, I stop by your stand every year just to like taste whatever else you got going on. Because I love
not me, BrewDog.
Yeah.
Tyler, I do not have a stand at Great American Beer Fest.
And if he did, I'd be offended he didn't invite me. But no, BrewDog are one of my favorite breweries. Especially during this quarantine, the way they're treating their employees, they're taking pay cuts. The two founders are actually not taking a salary right now. Their COO took a 50% pay cut. Just to try and make sure that they can keep everyone employed. And they've started making hand sanitizer that they're giving away to health workers and the health services in the UK for free and to anyone who's in need. So they are an amazing company.
Yeah. And I want to reiterate, thank you for publishing your recipes. And this one turned out really great. So
yeah,
if all the homebrewers out there that are listening, if you want a good place to go get some inspiration, check out the BrewDog recipe book.
And you know, if the BrewDog guys listen to this podcast and go, this is the best thing I've ever listened to, or not the best thing they've ever listened to, but would like to come on, we would love to have you on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you have an open invitation.
What kind of flavors did you like in this one? Like, what did you get out of there?
You know, I got kind of caramel and a roastiness to it, which was just delightful. And I'm actually drinking it the day we're recording. It's cold and snowy outside, and this is like the perfect like cold weather drink.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I was actually a little nervous about the amount of smoked malt.
Mm-hmm.
4 pounds it seems
four
like
pounds
lot.
Is a lot of smoked, and I gotta say, like, there is a smokiness to it. I've used smoked malt in the past, and it is not always my favorite thing to use. Mm-mm. But it really, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think what it's almost like having a coffee for a beer. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't like coffee, which is... Yeah.
Well, no, like that kind of warm, smoky feeling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Scottish whiskies, the really, really good ones tend to be peaty, so maybe that's what I'm picking up on.
Yeah.
Smoke isn't... What I'm trying to say is, in a very inelegant way, is the smoke isn't overwhelming.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't come out really overwhelming. In fact, I mean, I would probably still... I can still taste it. I would almost take it down to like 3.75 pounds.
Yeah.
Just to see if that... makes a difference, but really it came out and it's not overwhelmingly smoky, so don't worry about that. If you guys don't like smoke, it's still there on the nose, but it's not terrible. So.
It's not like drinking a Lagavulin whiskey, if you've had that, which is like one of the peatiest whiskeys out there. I love it. I had my wife try one once, and that didn't go well.
Yeah. I imagine. Yeah,
I don't know why.
So what beer did you make for your Bond Hero?
I made a Roger Moore Mild. And so I was thinking about my favorite Bonds and everything, and a lot of them tend to be Roger Moore movies. And I was like, well, what kind of characteristics are there of Roger Moore? And he is a very mild man in James Bond. He's ironically not a man of action in action movies.
He's very even-keeled.
Very even-keeled.
Reasonable.
And so I wanted to brew something that was low in alcohol, which is ironic for James Bond, but low in alcohol, something that you could enjoy multiple of, and, you know, really just kind of, I don't know, just feel nice about it. So yeah. I decided to brew an English mild. And so, unlike Tyler's, this is a super simple recipe. Which I put together after doing research on English milds, and I think I stole and replaced from like 5 different recipes. So it's 7 pounds of Maris Otter, 1 pound of flake oats, 8 ounces of British crystal malt, and then 8 ounces of carapils. And then this only has 1 ounce of hops in it. It's half an ounce of EKG at the 90-minute mark, and then half an ounce of EKG at the 20-minute mark. So super simple to brew, and 90-minute mash, 90-minute boil, and then obviously an English yeast for the fermentation. It actually came out a little stronger than I meant it to. I was going for like a 3.5% beer, and this came out at 4%. So woo! If you're in Britain,
yikes.
this will knock your socks off. And then I. You know, as is my wont, I put it on nitro, and it was just a really nice, easy drinking pint to have in the house, which was good because at the time my other beer on tap was an 11% stout, so it was a good even keel.
Yeah, I love this beer. It was like nice and malty, but it was like it had a good freshness to it. Like it wasn't heavy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good beer to like, you know, sit out on the porch and just drink on a nice warm day.
Yeah.
Which normally, like with a malty beer, I don't do that. I like more like floral or IPAs or cleaner beers. But this one came out and it was perfect to just... I think we drank it when we were brewing one day, didn't we?
We were drinking it the day we brewed our lagers that since got infected.
Should we tell the fine listeners about our troubles since our last season?
Yeah, I kind of want to do an off-flavor episode. I think that'd be really interesting.
Okay.
So we decided because I had fridge space. So we decided for future episodes, we would each do a lager. And so I was doing a Helles, and Tyler, you're doing a Märzen?
I know, a Maybach.
A Maybach. And we followed our recipes. We followed every standard you're supposed to follow. We cleaned, sanitized everything. While we're doing the lagering process and, you know, making sure that everything's following track, I took a taste the other night, and they each had a horrible medicinal kind of iodine smell and taste to it. And what was really shameful was we brewed this right at the beginning of all this COVID-19 awfulness in the States. Mm-hmm. So early mid-March. And when it got announced Colorado was going to a lockdown, I went down to the Brew Hut, which shout out to them. They're an essential business and are doing curbside pickups, and we love them. And so I went and got recipes for two beers, and these were going to be my quarantine beers. These were beers I've brewed 1,000 times before, one being the Jelly Donut from Ready Player One, and one being the Vanilla Cream Ale from Ghostbusters. Well, I took a taste of our lagers, and they had this awful taste. Then I took a taste of my other two beers, and they had the same off flavors. And that was a very bad day for me.
15 gallons of beer just gone.
20 gallons.
20 gallons, including mine.
And so talking to the guys at the Brew Hut, based on the off flavors, what they believe it was is that there was too much chlorophyll in the water on the days we brewed. Because when you're using city water, you obviously don't have control of the elements in there. And so different levels kind of go up and down. And the yeast attaches to the chlorophyll and creates this god-awful taste. There's no way you can get it out. You can't lager it out. And so we had to dump all of those. And apparently the way you do it, which you should generally do as a good rule of thumb anyway, is to use Camden tablets, which basically neutralize those agents in the water. Just brewed the Jelly Donut again this weekend because my wife really likes it and it's our quarantine beers. And so I'll be taking a test of it on Friday before I brew two more beers this weekend to make sure that that's okay. And if it isn't, I'm going to go and buy 20 gallons of reversed osmosis water. So
Yeah.
So even though Denver has very good water, a good thing is, and I'm not anywhere near that in my skill set, is to kind of do water testing and make sure you know what is in and isn't in your water. I am 90% certain that was the issue, because I've actually had this off flavor randomly before. And the fact that it's always the same infection, that's the only thing that I can think of.
So it's been a rough week outside of quarantine.
Yeah.
It got even rougher. I only lost 5 gallons. I only lost 15.
It got even rougher because it's like, I'm about to be a lot more sober.
Yeah. Also, going back to your list, literally the worst movie on Rotten Tomatoes for James Bond. Guess which one it is.
Die Another Day.
No. A View to Kill.
Okay. No.
No, it is the worst one on this list of Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, but I would also like it known that Rotten Tomatoes gave The Last Jedi one of the highest scores of Star Wars. So
we can talk about that on another episode.
We'll talk about that on another episode.
But the third worst movie on the list was The Man with the Golden Gun. So
oh, there you go. What was the second lowest?
The second lowest is Octopussy.
Okay, neither one of us had that, so we can feel good about ourselves.
Yeah. Pierce Brosnan is in the bottom. So those three are the bottom three. The next three after that are Pierce Brosnan movies. World Is Not Enough, Die Another Day, Tomorrow Never Dies. All right, what is the best movie on Rotten Tomatoes?
I'm going to go with Skyfall.
Nope.
Goldfinger?
Yeah, Goldfinger is the best.
All right.
Followed by Casino Royale, which they're wrong.
Yeah, fair enough.
To see all my reasons why. Just rewind to my rant about poker games on a movie. And then the number three is Dr. No.
Rotten Tomatoes, controversial opinions as always.
Four is From Russia with Love, and five is Skyfall. I had at least three out of my five as the top five.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to say I have a better taste in movies than you do, but I'm just saying Rotten Tomatoes and I agree very closely.
All right, well, shall we wrap it up?
Yeah, we should probably wrap this
up. We should wrap it up before it gets personal. As always, thank you so much for listening. As we're recording this, obviously the world is in a horrible shit show right now, so we do hope that everyone is honestly safe and healthy. If you want to reach out to the show, you can email us at popculturebrews@gmail.com, or you can get us on Twitter at popculturebrews, which is also a handle on Instagram. You can reach out to me on Twitter at SaundersBrew.
And you can reach out to me on Twitter at TMabes1.
Thanks so much.
Toodles.
Toodles.